So I think we spent, what, close to 3 hours last week talking about the new betas and all the announcements, and wasn't enough time because we have more beta tidbits to talk about that we've learned in the last week. You want to start with iOS 18, Mayo?
Yeah, there's, I mean, big betas, like a lot of announcements last week. They almost could have done WWDC without the intelligence section.
Yeah, you
know, it was close to it, but they packed it in.
The focus on math is like everywhere throughout the operating systems, it seems like. We found last week that anywhere basically that you can enter text on your iPhone or your iPad in iOS 18 or iPadOS 18, you can do math functions. So you type like 5 times 5 and then put the equal sign and it'll autofill 25. And you can tap like in the QuickType bar above the keyboard to show your work, so show the full equation or to just show the answer. So it's kind of like a built-in calculator anywhere you need it, which is pretty cool, I think.
Yeah, and you do like it does like currency conversions and like unit conversions as well. It's like pretty handy once you realize that you can do it. Like that's the kind of thing where in 7 months' time, it will go around on like social media. Like, did you know if you type this in the keyboard, it will calculate it for you? It's like, yeah. But, that's the thing that kind of will just recur and recur forever more because people, you know, stumble upon it randomly one day and they'll be like, this is new. It's like, I don't think so. The calculator app on beta 1 is a bit glitchy. Like, if you type in a number and then you like press back, it like there's like a frame lag or something where it kind of the word kind of flicks around. So hopefully they can clean it up. But it is nice. And even on iPhone, you can get to the history on the side and you can open Math Notes within the calculator. But then I don't really know why you'd want to use the Math Notes section rather than just like Notes app, because Notes app does the same thing. Like obviously on the iPad you can do the drawing stuff, but on the phone it's basically just like a siloed off note area. But I guess some people like the separation where they, if they have calculations, they can always store them in calculator and not like notes. But I don't really see why I would use the math note section on the iPhone specifically. But they've definitely given people a lot of options if you want to compute stuff.
A lot of ways to do your computing. In the Home app, there's now an option to select your preferred Home Hub. So in the past, the Home app has attempted to varying degrees of success to do this intelligently. So it'll pick a HomePod or an Apple TV in your house and make that your home hub. And it'll switch depending on, I don't entirely know what, just randomly, it seems most of the time. Well, now you can go into the Home app and choose a HomePod or an Apple TV to be your preferred Home Hub. This is a finally, I think, for a lot of people.
Yep, I've been wanting this since I'm existing and I actually start using it. Because I think the sensible option is to use your Apple TV as the dedicated Home Hub because it has the best connection to the internet in almost invariably all cases, and it has the thread routers built in, and it has all the stuff, and it's the most powerful chip. So you're stacking the deck in your favor if you're using the Apple TV as the Home Hub. However, randomly, mine always like switch into like the original generation HomePod for some reason. So I try and get it on the Apple TV, and then I'll check it, and then I'll come back up a few weeks later and look, and it's like flicked over to the HomePod for some reason. So like,
that's the intelligence at work.
So at least now, in theory, you can choose and it won't do the automatic selection stuff. For me right now, I can't actually try this because I think you have to have like all your home hubs updated to the beta for it to show up.
Figure it out either. It's just not there.
I have a weirdness. This happened last year too, where my HomePods do not see any betas. Like I opt into the beta. I have an OG HomePod pair and a modern HomePod pair, and neither of them will ever update to a beta of any description for undecipherable reason. So all I have is the Apple TV running the tvOS 18 beta, but hopefully by the time this is all public, I'll actually be able to pick the Apple TV explicitly rather than just cross my fingers and hope that it's the one that says connected.
In the wallet app in iOS 18, there's an interesting change where if you're adding your ID to your wallet app, you might be asked to take a live photo to prove that you're like a real person and to verify your identity. I don't know. I put this in here just because it's interesting and suggests that maybe Apple's had some fraud problems with adding IDs to Apple Wallet. And also because I I think I mentioned a few weeks ago, now that we're in Baltimore, Maryland is one of the states that supports IDs in Apple Wallet. And I think I'm going to try to go get my Maryland ID here soon. So I'm curious to see if I have to go through that extra step of verification.
That'd be cool, though, if you're in a state now that has the,
yeah, I
mean, the digital wallet.
One of the, like, five. I don't know where they let
you use it, but you have it. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, like, I think you can use it at, like, the DC airport, maybe, is one of the locations around here. Maybe some bars, but I don't ever really get carded at bars to begin with. So, yeah. It'll at least look pretty because there's some really good animation.
The live photo thing is probably defending against, like, if I have my phone and I steal your ID card and then I just, like, add your ID card, yeah, to my phone, the idea is you can, like, take a photo and, like, prove the photographically it matches up, I guess.
Because in the past, I think you had to do, like, the Face ID style setup where you turn your head, like, around the circle when you add an ID to wallet. And now this says that you might have to do that in addition to the live photo. So something.
It might be some states or some providers aren't happy that they don't have an actual, you know, photo with RGB pixels that actually they can look at rather than just like a 3D representation.
There's also some changes to CarPlay that we didn't talk about last week and that haven't really been mentioned everywhere because everybody's focused on next generation CarPlay. But there are some changes to the current version of CarPlay. When you get notifications, there are now profile pictures in the notification. So if you text me, I not only see Benjamin Mayo, your name, but also your profile picture next to it, which is nice if you're driving and you just look out of the corner of your eye and I see your picture. I don't have to read your name. It's useful. In the Maps app too, they did this on iPhone too, where they made a lot of like the points of interest colors bolder and the text bolder. This is also on CarPlay and it's a really nice change. Again, because you can just look at a glance and see a better idea of where you are on the map. There's also a change for non-CarPlay cars too, where there's a setting, and I think it's under sounds and haptics or somewhere in the settings app. You can choose to enable a feature that makes Siri over Bluetooth sound better when connected to a car without CarPlay. Like, it would default back to like the phone call quality sound for Siri interactions, but now that's no longer the case.
That's cool. They've also done something with the audio codecs on the Mac too.
I saw this and I still don't fully understand how they're doing what they're doing.
I don't know either, but I think it's something to do with the LC3 codec, which they've been experimenting with for a while. So I think now, at least on AirPods only, they'll default to using LC3, which lets them do higher audio quality. Whereas before, the traditional Bluetooth codec, as soon as you activate the microphone, it would have to put the bitrate of the music really, really low. So with LC3, they don't have to do that. I think it might be AirPods only, though. And it might only be certain generations of AirPods. Apple hasn't really like detailed this yet or documented it, so we're kind of stabbing at the wind. But they're at least experimenting with a better solution there.
And that could change too, because they've been experimenting with LC3 for like, I think I searched our site and we wrote about it like 2 years ago or something. It's been a long time in the making. But the macOS thing is nice too, because if you're wearing AirPods and you get a call like from your iPhone and you have that continuity feature turned on so the call rings on your Mac too, the phone call starts ringing and your music or podcast or whatever just goes to crap. You didn't do anything, just your phone rings and then... It's a very jarring transition. Mayo, last week for macOS Sequoia 2, you were wondering how the new iPhone mirroring feature works for notifications when you also have an app on your Mac, right? That was your question?
Yep, because I didn't want to get duplicates from like Apple News, right? So you don't have multiple banners. Well, I was hypothesizing maybe they could do some AI solution where they identify duplicates and filter them out. Turns out they got a much simpler route. Basically, if it detects that there's an app on your Mac that you also have on your iPhone, the iPhone notifications for the app don't mirror. So news on Mac, news on phone, you won't get news notifications from the iPhone come to the Mac. It will just assume that you're getting the notifications through the news app. And there is a second screen where you can manually choose which apps you want to. So if there are some apps that you only want to go to the phone and not to the Mac, you can disable it. It's just like the mirror notifications for the watch. You know, you go to the watch app and you can choose there. It's like that, but on the Mac itself. So that is their solution. I will not be getting duplicate notifications for Apple News. I don't know why I didn't think about this, but it's a very simple solution. If the app exists on the Mac, the phone won't report it. And if you have like different bundle IDs or you've downloaded the Mac app from the web and it doesn't like associate with like the App Store app, you can just manually turn it off if you want to.
The new window snapping feature in macOS Sequoia is useful. I'm running the beta and it's useful so far to a certain degree, but that's another topic about window management in general. But one thing I saw some people complain about is that when you snap a window, whether it's to the side or the corner, it leaves a small margin. And people didn't like this. They want their windows pressed all the way up against the edges of their screen or to other windows on their screen. Turns out in system settings, there is a checkbox to disable leaving margins between tiled windows.
The margins just give it some space and prettiness, and it means the shadows don't overlap too heavily. But I guess if you want to maximize every single pixel, you can turn that, just change that setting around.
You know, my screen is just so small that I have to take up every pixel on this 32-inch beautiful display.
Yeah, every pixel counts. The Pro displays, yeah. It's at a real expense. You can't afford that 5 pixels of padding between two windows.
Every pixel counts. WatchOS 11. It has changes to the smart stack. You were talking about this too last week, Mayo. It was one of your complaints.
Mm-hmm.
What was it? Basically, smart stack took over the watch face?
Yeah, so they're trying to make the smart stack more popular. Mm-hmm. And so in the past, where you would have like a timer running or music running, it would go and it would like launch the music app on the phone or like the Now Play interface, so you can control it like a podcast. Well, now by default, it opened the smart stack, and the top item on the stack is a, you know, live activity card for the playing song or playing podcast. And you can press pause from that screen, but you can't see much else. It's just that small, thin rectangle.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out they are making sure that people don't get too annoyed, because there's also a preference for that. So if you go into the watch settings, you can choose for media apps to still either launch the smart stack or launch the app, which is the old previous behavior. So I've changed it back. And then also there's the new default on WatchOS 11 is live activities that are running also go to a smart stack first rather than the clock face or opening the app. And there's also settings for that as well. So I think like a timer will now default to going to the smart stack when you raise your wrist. So you'll get like...
Okay.
The thing with the smart stack is half the screen is taken up by the date and the time. So yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like it's very... For me, it's not a good use of space, because I like the clock face that I selected, but I get the utility of the widget. So I kind of feel like a better direction for the smart stack would be to like just show, like overlay the widget carousel on the clock face, so you don't duplicate the you don't have like a second clock and a second date. You just show the widgets over the top of the clock face, and then you can swipe them away or swipe them up. But that's not how it works. The other thing I would like for the smart stack is when you do it, when it does show in that like automatic mode, the date and time are huge. I don't really need that to take up half the screen. I would prefer if it opened expanded, i.e. it's showing two cards at the start rather than just like one and the rest to collapse down. That option doesn't exist. But they're definitely trying to push the smart stack as a thing with WatchOS 11. But I don't find the appeal of the smart stack has really improved. They just now put it on by default in more places. But you can turn it off, which I have currently done.
I guess another side effect of the focus on the smart stack in WatchOS 11 is the Siri watch face, which is completely gone. Can't use it anymore. So this means that WatchOS 11 not only doesn't add a single watch face, it takes one away. So we're negative one for this release, which is not great. Yeah,
we're currently in minus numbers. Again, they might have some surprise watch face additions with the final version. They've done that before. They don't always announce them in the summer. Sometimes they hold them back and announce them in the fall, especially if there are new watch hardware that maybe the clock faces need to lay out differently and they don't want to spill the beans too early. But yeah, right now we're currently seeing a minus one new faces in this release, which is a record low.
A record low.
The Siri face disappearing is pretty sensible, I think. Like,
it's because of the smart stack thing, right?
You think mostly superseded in functionality by the smart stack. Yeah. Exactly. Because the Siri face was the only face where you couldn't use the crown to scroll up to the smart stack. So on WatchOS 10,
that's right.
If you chose the Siri face, you couldn't, like, if you scrolled, it would scroll the Siri timeline, right? It wouldn't go to the smart stack at all. So apart from the fact that there was that incompatibility, there was also just a lot of overlapping functionality where the same items would appear on the smart stack that appear on the Siri phase. And I think also the smart stack was smarter than the Siri phase, so it would have more information and it would be better at surfacing relevant options. So the Siri phase was a good idea at the time when it came out, more like watchOS 3 or whatever, but it didn't get much appeal, it didn't get much uptake, and they've kind of come up with a better system that's now available on any clock face.
So you're running the watchOS 11 beta?
Yep.
Are you running anything? You're running iOS, watchOS, anything else?
tvOS.
Oh yeah, lots of things to investigate there.
One thing that is funny on TVOS is there's now a setting. You know, last year they made it so that instead of there being 5 app icons per row on the home screen, there's 6. Mm-hmm. Well, clearly some people didn't like that, because in the TVOS 18, there's a setting to turn it back again and have 5 per row. But I like the 6 per row.
I like the 6 too, yeah.
It makes a much. If you've got like a 65-inch TV, the 6 per row is a much better density. I guess if you've got like small TVs, like, you know, the 20-inch or 30-inch screens, maybe you want 5. So yeah, they've given you a setting option there. But yeah, I haven't done the Mac beta because I do have critical work requirements, so I'm always a bit more nervous about the Mac beta, although it seems less disruptive this year, right? There's just less going on.
Yeah.
So, and the best, but also that means there's not as much value in upgrading because there's less stuff to try mm-hmm. out right now.
I installed Sequoia and I couldn't tell you why I did it. I guess I did it to try the window snapping thing.
Window snapping.
Which doesn't work for my multitasking after all. So now I'm just running Sequoia and it's the same as Sonoma. Just prettier wallpapers.
The best feature, the iPhone mirroring, isn't available yet.
And yeah.
I don't think it's scheduled to be part of the 0.0. It's coming in a 0.1 or something.
So. I mean, universal control was... That was iOS 15, then it was iOS like 15.4 or something. It was really late in the process, so that doesn't bode well for our iPhone mirroring.
And I would run HomePod betas if they would install.
If they would allow you to.
I can't get them to do it. Happy Hour This Week is brought to you by Ladder. If you're anything like me, you have a certain tendency to put things off until the very last minute. Dentists, optician's appointments, filing taxes, that kind of stuff. And you know, it's usually fine, but you shouldn't mess around and wait when it comes to life insurance. Get term coverage life insurance through Ladder today. Go to ladderlife.com/happyhour to see if you're instantly approved. You know, I've started needing glasses recently, and that kind of hit me as a moment of I'm getting older, and stuff like life insurance somehow feels immediately more relevant. Life insurance gives you the peace of mind to know that your family will be taken care of if the worst happens. Ladder is a 100% digital service when you apply for $3 million in coverage or less. That means no doctors, no needles, and no paperwork. It's all done online. You just need a phone or laptop to apply. You fill out Ladder's application form, and their smart algorithms work in real time and tell you instantly if you're approved. Ladder has no hidden fees and you can cancel at any time. Get a full refund if you cancel within the first 30 days. And Ladder's policies are issued by insurers with long proven histories of paying claims. And Ladder's customers rate them 4.8 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot. If you've been thinking about getting life insurance, Ladder is the place to do it. If you aren't sure but you just want some more information, go on Ladder's website, fill out their online calculator, and you can see the costs and terms of the plan with no commitment. And as the cost of life insurance goes up as you age, now is the time to act and get it done. So go to ladderlife.com/happyhour today to see if you're instantly approved. That's ladderlife.com/happyhour. One more time, ladderlife.com/happyhour.
So the best thing about the M4 iPad Pro, now that I've been using it for a few weeks, is the thin and light design. So thin, so light, it's the first thing you notice pretty much every time you pick it up. Well, Mark Gurman says that that's just the first step in what apparently is Apple's new design language, design focus, making all the things as thin as possible. So he says the iPhone will get thinner, the MacBook will get thinner, and the Apple Watch will get thinner. No real details on when or how much thinner, but the thinner iPhone has, of course, been rumored, as we've talked about with the iPhone 17 Slim, 17 Ultra. And it sounds like that design language will just extend everywhere.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that the current, like, next generations or the current lineups will just all be thinner. It right. might mean that they're adding additional models into the mix. Like with the iPhone situation, in 2025, we're currently expecting iPhone 17 to be like iPhone 16, the current models, you know, the four phones, plus this high-end option with the iPhone 17 Ultra. For the watches, that might also be true. For the Macs, he specifically says MacBook Pro, not MacBook Air, which is interesting. But I think there's... like, they went almost too far with the MacBook Pro 2021. Like, they were addressing people's complaints, and it was a clear breakpoint from the Johnny Ive design MacBook Pro, right? And so they were making a statement. But you can look at that thing, you can look at the state of Apple Silicon, and you can look at the performance that they can eke out of a 5.1mm iPad Pro. I feel like the MacBook Pro's could shave a few millimeters somewhere, you know? Like, it just feels a bit of a tank. I love it. It's great. I love the laptop. But you do kind of feel like they could probably shrink it a little bit. So I think what's happening here is the fashion for a while was to ensure stability on battery life, on ports, on, you know, conservative designs while they introduced Apple Silicon across the Macs especially. And now they've got a bit of, like, jive in their step. The efficiency, they're finding ways to be more efficient in terms of heat management, like what we've seen with the thermal design on the iPad Pro, and that's allowing them to do like a generation of fashion where stuff is thinner. And is since before the iPad Pro, it was a long time where Apple introduced like thin products. That used to be their go-to, yeah. Right? The thinnest phone ever, the thinnest thing ever, and then that kind of fell away as they prioritized other things like battery life and waterproofing, and they even had features like 3D Touch, which added like a millimeter and a half, and then they got rid of 3D Touch and they just replaced it with battery. So like, there's all these like reasons for everything, but it had been a while since the iPhone had got like notably thinner. In fact, it's only got thicker. So now feels like a decent time to do it. I presume they can do it with no compromises. And I think if you kind of take a bird's eye view, they probably will be able to achieve it. I think there's room or slack in the MacBook Pro design to make it a bit thinner and more compact and maybe a bit lighter too. The Apple Watch, everyone said it should be thinner from the beginning, I think, right? And they've done redesigns to it, but they've never really made it thinner. In fact, I believe it got thicker for a while. I don't know where it lands right now. I think it's thinner than the original watch, but it's not like the thinnest it's ever been because they incorporated new sensors and cellular and, you know, so there were like functional reasons for it, but it's been a few generations. I would love it to get a bit thinner on the wrist, a bit slimmer on the wrist. It always gets caught on my like shirt sleeve because it just sticks out slightly too much, and it would look pretty smart if they could make it more low profile. And then the phone's the most interesting one for me because I feel like you can imagine how they can make the Macs and the watches thinner. The phone has the big problem in terms of the camera bump, which is something the iPad Pro doesn't really have to contend with because the iPad has a worse camera than the phones do. And so while the camera does stick out, it's only slightly, and it's a very small percentage of the overall surface area of the iPad, right? It's just one tiny little camera lens in the corner. Most of the iPad is thin.
They took away a camera with this new iPad Pro too, so if whether that was due to the thinness or something else, like, they clearly made that calculus somewhere in the process.
Yeah, when you look at the phone, you can't ship a phone these days that doesn't have a good camera, right? Like, people wouldn't accept that trade-off. It wouldn't be popular. So you've got to have at least as good a camera as the current phones, and the camera bump on the current phones is pretty significant, even with the current thicker body. So if you're going to make a thinner phone, what are you going to do about the camera? It's a big question mark for me, because they surely can't make the camera bump significantly less so it can be, you know, everybody says they want the cameras to be flush with the phone again, but optically it's never going to happen. You'd have to take a real... unless we find some incredible innovation, you're just going to be stuck with either bad camera quality or a protrusion. So you're going to have protrusion. If you make the rest of the phone thinner around it, the protrusion stands out even more, right? Because now there's a bigger contrast between the camera bump and the rest of the phone. And in terms of the percentage of surface area, the camera bump takes up way more of the phone's surface area than the camera bump on the iPad. So if you're going to try and present, like... You announce the iPhone 17 Ultra, like, it's our thinnest design ever, and they do that side shot, and there's just a big lump at the top of it. The impact isn't quite the same, right? Like, yeah, it will look different, and there'll be a different design, and that always gets people excited, but you can't really push on, like, the thinnest device ever mantra. Like, with the iPad Pro, they can get away with it. Technically, if you include the camera bump thickness, the iPad Pro is not the thinnest device ever. But because it's only, like, you know, a couple of millimeters only in one small corner, they can just show a big iPad and kind of ignore the little extrusion in the top left corner, and people get away and people accept it because most of the product is 5.1 millimeters. With the phone, that's not going to be the case. So how they position that is more complicated.
The rumor for the iPhone 17, which will be the first phone, presumably with this ultra-thin design language, is that the camera will be centered on the back. I don't know how that plays into the overall thinness strategy, if moving it over does allow them to push more of the camera back inside the phone. But that is another calculus Apple's making for that transition.
I mean, I'm not a genius, right? But just instinctively, you put the camera in the middle, you're then overlapping with more components because
like the Face ID and the
camera system in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I feel like if you wanted to make it thinner, you'd try and keep them separated. I wouldn't put them top middle because then the internal space is going to be competing with the front camera. So we don't know. We haven't seen like schematics yet for the iPhone 17 Ultra. We just got these like descriptions. And so it sounds pretty drastic. So we have to wait for more details to know for sure exactly, you know, so we can have like a good mental picture of what it is. But it'll be a cool phone.
I just don't
necessarily think the thinness impact will be the same as like the iPad is.
Part of the impact with the iPad, though, in addition to the thinness, is the reduction in weight. It's significantly lighter than before, which particularly for the MacBook Pro, I think would go a long way towards solving the it's a tank kind of problem. You know, it can be thinner, but if you're able to make it thinner and then also offer that substantial decrease in weight, that's the perfect combination. And for a lot of people, the decrease in weight will be more notable, more important than the thinness. It's kind of like what we saw with the iPhone 14 Pro to the iPhone 15 Pro, where they're the same thickness, if not a little thicker, but they're significantly lighter because of the titanium. But I think you kind of said it best when you said it's just fashion. And we've seen this ebb and flow over the years. Like, look at the iPhone 5 to the iPhone 6. And the iPhone 6, you could argue they went too far in making it as thin as possible because you could bend it in half and snap it in two. But then over the years, we had the rounded design, the thin design through like the iPhone 11 series. And then the iPhone 12 came around and it's thicker, it's boxier, and it's kind of just gotten thicker and heavier every year since then. The difference this time, though, is the Apple Silicon world and the world we live in where Apple's not constrained, their designs aren't constrained by a third party like Intel. And that's particularly going to be important on the Mac, where the M4 iPad Pro has so much power, and it's so thin and light, and it doesn't have a fan. All of that bodes well to seeing the same design language applied proportionally to something like the MacBook Pro.
Why is the MacBook Air omitted?
Well, for the same reason maybe that the iPad Air is thicker and heavier than the iPad Pro. I mean,
right, pricing differentiation.
Air doesn't mean thin and light anymore, apparently. And the current MacBook Air design is just so good. The MacBook Air right now is like the 2018 iPad Pro, where they just made it too good. They made it so good that I don't know where they go for here. And I have a feeling maybe they don't know where they go from here in terms of the design.
They can make the Air thinner, though. Like, maybe not for the price point, but if they wanted to do like, you know, the style factor.
Yeah.
It's you have an iPad Pro with 5.1 millimeters running an M4 chip. Two iPad Pros, 13-inch stacked on top of each other, are still thinner than one MacBook Air. Like, and that's double the screen, double the battery, blah, 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 blah. Like, I just feel like physically it must be a way to make it thinner and smaller if they really wanted to. You know, they could do like a 12-inch MacBook design with a 15-inch screen kind of style. Because the 12-inch, for all of its faults, it was small. And like,
oh, yeah.
had that wow factor on the thinness. The wedge... I know people love the wedge. I take it or leave it. But the wedge did give an impression of the overall product being more thin, I think. Even though like the new design squared off Air is thinner, it's, you know, thinner than the thickest point of the old Air, because the other one tapered down to nothing, it had that like different feel to it. So I do think with the Air there is more scope to also go thinner, but
yeah,
the Air now is like, budget's the wrong word, but the inexpensive option, so they don't want to do their drastic design stuff that probably costs them and they have to invest in the tooling and stuff. Like, that current Air design is very popular. People are very happy with it. It's going to continue on for a while, as is.
The Apple Watch changes, the Apple Watch getting thinner, also plays into a report from Ming-Chi Kuo this week, where he says, the Apple Watch series... God, I'm so bad at numbers now. We're going into the Series 10 this year, right?
Or Series X, depending on...
Or Series X. Series X, Series 10. He says that the screens, or the sizes, are going from 41 millimeter and 45 millimeter to 45 millimeter and 49 millimeter. So for context, the Apple Watch Ultra right now is 49 millimeters.
And the current Series 9 watches are 41 and 45. So you'd be dropping the 41, the new baseline would be the 45, which is the current big watch that isn't the Ultra.
And that's a dramatic change. I mean, I know you more than most people are going to be quite worked up about this if this is what happens, because you are a small watch user. I use the Apple Watch Ultra.
My wrists are so small. I could not put a 45 millimeter watch on the wrist. Like, the 41 was pushing it. Like, I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but somewhere between 41 and 45, it just gets too big for the amount of space I have on my wrist. I've always bought the small watch, even though... the big watch screen size, I do appreciate. It just looks stupid on my arm. So I had the 38mm. Remember, the Apple Watch started at 38mm for the original. And it got so much praise at the time for having a smaller form factor than every other smartwatch that was around. Like, all the Android ones were way bigger. And so, especially, you know, like, female market, it was very appealing. But I loved it for that reason too. And then it creeped up to 41mm. Okay. 41 to 45? Like,
that's the biggest jump yet.
Yeah. And the thing that you have to remember with the watch sizing, it is not diagonal screen size that's measured.
Correct.
It's case height. For the tradition in the watch industry is to measure by top to bottom. So when it says 41 millimeters, that's like top to bottom. The overall watch, not the screen, the overall watch is that tall. So you can't even say, like, well, they're going to mitigate it with thinner bezels, because that's not what it's measuring. It's not measuring diagonal screen size. It's measuring physical size of the body of the watch. So if this rumor is correct, I'm going to be a bit screwed.
Yeah. Because
I don't know what I'd do if the nice... like, the Ultra is huge. The 45mm is huge. Is there just not going to be a 41mm anymore? Like, I kind of... think they can't ditch it entirely, because I feel like it's pretty popular. It's not like the 41mm is like a rare choice. I don't know the numbers, but it seems like half the population probably buy the 41mm one.
Yeah. I think so. And I mean, my theory when I saw this is maybe they're just adding a new model to the Apple Watch lineup, and Kuo has things a little bit mixed up, so we'd have like the Apple Watch at 41 and 45, and then the Apple Watch Pro at 45 and 49, and then the Ultra at 49. One of the biggest benefits of the Ultra is the battery life, the big screen, and of course, like, the hiking and diving features. So there's still that bifurcation between the 49 millimeters on both of them. But
so the battery life and the hiking features and the durability and the crown guard stuff, sure. Screen size, interesting enough, a 49 millimeter Series 9 design would have a bigger screen than the 49mm Ultra.
Oh, because of the bezels.
Yeah. Yeah. So, on that basis, if you want the bigger screen, you'd then be not getting the Ultra, which I would agree. If you take Kuo's article as correct, other than him calling it the Series 10, this kind of sounds like more models in the line, like an Apple Watch Pro kind of scenario.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you'd have, like, the current watches carry on, and maybe for this fall, they don't even have a new 41mm. You just expected to buy a Series 9, and they just roll it over like that. But then they could add in, like, an Apple Watch Pro lineup, and then the Ultra refresh, which, I mean, they refreshed the Ultra 2 with basically no changes, so they'll probably do that again. But the Apple Watch Pro, if we assume that, would then be the new darling with the new design. Maybe this is the design that breaks band compatibility, and it's like the really drastic redesign.
Mm-hmm.
And then that comes to a 4. I did predict this, or at least that outcome, when I bought my Series 9, because the rumors of the, you know, 10th generation redesign were circling that time. I was like, I could see it only being available in the bigger watch size.
Yeah, you did say that.
I did say that. And I don't know. I'd be happy because then that means my Series 9 purchase wasn't terrible, but then I'd be sad because I would be worried about the future of the watch for my wrist size. I have faith in Apple that they respect the diversity of people and people's different wrist sizes, and they were so intentional in doing the 38mm from the very beginning.
Yeah.
My situation right now, or at least my expectation, is the 41mm will survive, but it won't get a redesign this year. And maybe in a couple of years' time, they can then do a bit more miniaturization and bring out a 41mm next-gen model as well.
Wait, so what do you think the lineup will look like this fall then?
I think they'll sell the two Series 9s.
Okay.
Or at least just the 41mm Series 9 as is. Okay. Then they'll have new 45, 49s.
Yeah.
And then the Ultra, I guess, as well. And the biggest differentiation for the Ultra will be battery life. Like, the 49mm Pro would be going for, like, thinness and sleekness, right? The Ultra will get the 3-4 day battery life. So, if I was upgrading this year, it'd be very bad. Because I'd have to be buying last year's watch.
This is my year to upgrade, because I skipped last year. And my plan was just to get an Ultra 3. But this would maybe change the calculus a little bit, because I don't care about the hiking and diving and durability part of the Ultra. I like the size and I like the battery life. So I would have a decision to make between the two 49mm watches.
You'd have to choose screen size or battery, I guess.
Exactly, yeah.
And
I do like the battery life. And I think I would like it especially with the Ultra 3, because mine is showing its age already, the Ultra 1. Like, my battery life now is not as good as it was during the first 6 months to a year of life with the Apple Watch Ultra. So I don't know. It's going to be a decision to make.
I went on the Ultra, Quo said that it'll probably just get, like, the chip changes or whatever, and it'll be also maybe offered in dark colors. So, like, you get the dark titanium option.
Oh, that would be nice.
Yeah, not just the raw titanium option. Which we have, if I remember correctly, seen. Like, there was a leak or something of the design of...
Yeah, I think so.
It was right around the Ultra 2. Like, we were expecting a dark Ultra 2, and it didn't happen. So maybe that's finally coming to fruition.
Because I think what I said was that I would probably go from the Ultra 1 to the Ultra 2 if it was available in dark titanium. And it wasn't, so that saved me $800. So,
I mean, if my wrist could support the bigger screen size, I would choose the Pro over the Ultra.
Yeah.
Like, the screen size is going to be even bigger, I think, and it'll look the most modern and new. The Ultra, I just don't like the design language of it. Like, the whole, we're going to make it thicker and bulkier on purpose, never really, like, appeals to me.
Because the Ultra has the action button, which I literally have programmed to do nothing because I kept accidentally activating it. It has the design, it has the battery life. But one of my biggest problems with it are just, it's very boring. A, the design is boring, and B, finding a band that looks good with the design is really hard. Like, I don't think a lot of the traditional Apple Watch band designs look good with the boxy, big design of the Ultra. I use the Trail Loop, and I basically, of the 18 months I've had the Apple Watch Ultra, it's been with a Trail Loop basically the entire time, just because I like that style, and then it also, I think, looks the best of any Apple Watch band.
Well, if you want to buy a whole new set of bands, then you can get the new watch, because
that's true too.
The rumor is the existing bands won't be compatible, so you have to splurge a lot.
I'm excited to hopefully at least have a fun/different Apple Watch year this fall, because the Apple Watch upgrades, I'm sorry to the people who bought a Series 9, they have just been pretty boring most years. So, having some changes.
Really worried about
The
Apple Intelligence situation.
Yeah, I think the situation for the Apple Watch is that it's not happening for a while.
But what if they, like, put a better chip in, like, the next one, like the Series 10, and then
that's possible.
The Series 9 can't.
Then you're screwed.
Then I'm really screwed. I'm hoping the answer's going to be, well, we'll just let you relay from the phone. They just haven't announced that yet.
Remember how bad it was when it was relaying everything from the phone in the original Apple Watch days?
Bluetooth moved on a bit, and, like, I mean, it's better than not doing it at all.
that's fair.
I don't know. I mean, they've got a problem with Apple Intelligence for the HomePod and the watch. And I think, honestly, right now they don't have a good solution. Otherwise, they would have at least like teased it or something. So it's a bit of a question mark. If you were subscribed to Happy Hour Plus, you wouldn't be hearing this right now, or any of the ads in the show, in fact. Happy Hour Plus supports me and Chance directly, and you get bonus content in return. Each episode for members has an additional Plus segment at the end, covering more about Apple and tech, and we have dedicated bonus episodes every month as well. In the Plus segment for this episode, we're going to be talking more about iOS 18 and how it's received by regular people. Now, we, of course, love all our listeners, but if you want to help us out, now is a great time with Happy Hour Plus. Hear more from us, and you get all of the regular shows, too, completely ad-free. Subscribe at 9to5mac.com/join for $5 a month or $50 a year. You just sign up at 9to5mac.com/join, and you get a private RSS feed that you can add to whatever podcast app that you use, whether that's Apple, Spotify, Overcast, or any other. One more time, go to 9to5mac.com/join and subscribe to Happy Hour Plus today. Thanks to everyone who listens and supports the show.
So way back at WWDC 2022, Apple announced something called Apple Pay Later, a way to buy things online anywhere Apple Pay was accepted and finance that purchase over 4 weeks.
6 weeks.
6 weeks, yeah. Four payments over 6 weeks. And then they announced it in June of 2022, right? We didn't hear anything for a while. March of 2023, they quote-unquote officially launched it. A very slow, kind of staggered rollout.
Then yeah, it was like beta. It was like private beta, kind of. Yeah, March.
Invite-only beta, basically. Then October of last year, they launched it for everybody in the U.S., so anybody could finance their Apple Pay purchases, assuming they could get approved for the loan. And now it's dead. Less, what's that, 8 months after fully launching? Apple says that it is shutting down Apple Pay Later. There's not really a clear reason for why it's making this decision, but its Apple's emphasis is on the fact that iOS 18 adds integration with banks and credit card providers and other short-term financing companies directly into Apple Pay. So when iOS 18 launches, theoretically, you'll be able to make a purchase with Apple Pay and choose at the time of checkout to finance that purchase with your credit card company, a company like Affirm, instead of Apple Pay Later. It's basically Apple throwing in the towel on its own financing and saying, all of these companies offer a similar product. Let's just integrate that into Apple Pay and stop doing our own financing.
Which they could have done a year ago, it's not like the industry has bloomed since they made the decision to do Apple Pay Later. They chose to do Apple Pay Later to compete with the likes of Affirm and everybody else. And so now something has pushed them to leave the industry.
It's not a great business to be in, I don't think, especially with how interest rates and everything are right now. It's not a great business to be in when you're Apple and you don't charge fees, late fees, interest, or anything of the sort. Because if you look at something like Affirm, they do charge fees. They do charge varying amounts of interest depending on your credit, up to like 30% or something ridiculous. So Affirm has a business model in that regard. Apple Pay Later did not.
That's the thing, right? Apple was doing the kind of most hygienic version of Buy Now Pay Later that was possible.
Yes.
Where you spread the payment over 6 weeks with no interest. And at the end of the period, if you didn't pay it off, you know, your account would get blacklisted, you get banned or whatever, but you wouldn't be slapped with, you know, fees. You might get collections come around eventually, but they, like, what happens in like the Affirm case and how they make their money is they bet on people not paying off, and then the 6 weeks runs out, and then you get like a $500 surcharge added to your balance, then you have to start repaying. Like, the Apple Pay option was very explicitly, and they pushed it this way, as more fair and, you know, no fees, just like the Apple Card, right? But if there were losses, Apple just took it out of its own books, because this was also the first Apple-like financial service where they weren't distributing everything off to like a partner like Goldman Sachs or Green Dot Bank, which does Apple Pay Cash. The loans you were getting from Apple Pay Later were coming out of Apple's bank account, so they were on Apple's balance sheet directly. So I don't know if they started seeing losses and they got scared feet. Like, and then, you know, they started seeing the red numbers on their own profit and loss account, or something else triggered. I know there's some speculation there's like new regulation coming in that's cracking down on buy now, pay later in some regards in the US. So maybe the regulatory infrastructure Apple's not happy with, or feels like it's more trouble than it's worth. But
it's got to be that it's more trouble than it's worth, because Apple Pay later, based on a lot of the regulation that I've seen that is coming into effect, is to crack down on more of the 30% interest kind of payday loans, predatory mm-hmm. loan industry, not what Apple was doing. And maybe Apple's plan was to eventually gradually phase into charging interest and stuff. And then now they know that legislation is coming and they say, screw it, we're out.
Yeah, it is a curious one, because, I mean, you mentioned the timeline. It spent longer in the time between being announced and being released in private beta than it did actually as a public product, i.e. from October to now. So it was definitely a weird one on that basis. And all of the factors of the here and now that I'm aware of were well public knowledge when they were doing it 2 years ago. It's not like there's been a dramatic sea change. You can't even blame the interest rate environment. Like 2022, the interest rate environment was what it is now. So, you know, and Apple's got good financial people on staff. Like, you know, Luca Mastri and team would have done the forecast. So the way it was announced and, you know, it was so random does suggest there was some new information that came to light very recently that has made them change course. But I don't know what that is.
Do you remember it was just in February that Apple announced that they were working with Experian to show Apple Pay later on consumer credit reports? Mm-hmm. That was in February. And now, like you said, something has changed.
There was even in iOS 17.6, which is currently in beta, there's like strings relating to Apple Pay later have like changed to talk about different cases like bankruptcy and blah, 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 you know, other stuff. So it was like actively being developed until very, very, very recently.
It definitely gives off a vibe that it was a sudden decision, I think. Whether it was sudden because Apple ran the numbers and realized, oh, this is a terrible business, or it was sudden because of external factors, we don't know, but it gives the vibe of being a sudden move.
Do you think it has implications on the rest of Apple's financial services, like the Apple Card, which...
I think it highlights the fact that the Apple Card is probably a really, really bad business for Goldman Sachs, even though Goldman Sachs does charge interest on balances if you carry your Apple Card balance. But Goldman Sachs...
no additional fees.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no additional fees. There's no late fees. There's no annual fees. There's no foreign transaction fees. And Goldman Sachs is handing out a lot of zero interest loans to people financing Apple purchases. Because that's by far the biggest benefit of Apple Card, is financing your Apple purchases across 12.
The monthly
12.
Installments thing.
Yeah. And that's... I think Apple Card is here to stay in some form or fashion. It probably won't be with Goldman Sachs. And I think this suggests that it won't be in-house backed by Apple's own Apple financial services business. But I think they will find another partner and maybe make some changes to the product to make it a more sustainable business. I just think Apple Card is too big, too important for Apple's business for them to shelve it altogether. But if it came to a situation where Apple had to choose between shutting Apple Card down or putting Apple Card on its own books, like it did with Apple Pay later, that's a different problem. That's a different question. I don't know if Apple would do that. But if they can find another partner, like Synchrony has been rumored, Citibank has been rumored, then I think they'll do almost whatever it takes to keep it alive.
I just want them to just get Apple Pay Cash in more countries.
Like, that, yeah.
Apple Pay later was US only, but I didn't, you know, it doesn't specifically speak to my needs, fortunately. But Apple Pay Cash would be really useful and really handy. And in iOS 18, they got that fancy new animation, but still no country expansion.
I do look forward to hopefully getting some developments in the Apple Card situation soon, because that story that Goldman's looking for a way out has been circulating for almost a year now, I think. So,
well, wasn't it like the middle of last year that it was reported that Apple had agreed for an exit in 18 months' time?
Yep.
And that would be the end of this year, right? So
I think that agreement was Apple saying, if we can work something out, then the timeline would be 18 months. But if we can't work something out, then
you're still on the hook.
Yeah. So you better go out and find a solution.
Goldman Sachs signed the contract. They screwed themselves over.
Yeah.
So yeah. And I don't. I agree with you. The Apple Card is a different kettle of fish to the Apple Pay later. But what did they do at WWDC? They introduced alternative ways for other networks to show in the Apple Pay sheet, right? To support things like Affirm. And at the same time, they also expanded and made it easier for payment cards to be added to Apple Wallet, like the Apple Card, where you just tap the back of it and it registers it. There are some color release.
I mean, because I said last week that I thought that was regulatory or antitrust of some sort, but maybe it's not. I don't know. Things have changed in the last week. Like, we talk a lot about iPhone prices and iPhones getting more expensive and this iPhone Ultra coming that's going to stretch the prices even higher. Apple can advertise iPhone prices with carrier promotions, but it really helps that they can advertise iPhone prices with their own Apple Card financing. You can buy an iPhone, basically pay nothing the same day, get 3% cash back, and then just make your payments over the next 12 months. Whether or not that's financially smart or good for the world or good for consumers is up for debate. But for Apple, it sells a lot of iPhones, and it helps offset the price, the potential impact of price increases.
Yes, so if they were going to end the Apple Card, they would find an alternative financing option.
Yes.
Which they have had in the past with partners. Just like how they're getting rid of Apple Pay later, but they're going to offer you Affirm in the Apple Pay payment sheet, right? If they did drop the Apple Card, the monthly installments would continue. It would just be under a different brand with a different partnership with a different company.
And who knows if they would be interest-free, but because that could be the thing that makes Apple Card such a bad business, but who knows? I don't know. It's one of those things where Apple is entering these different industries and expanding, and I think they are learning just as we are learning the news. Like, there are certain things that I think Apple finds out that we find out at a very similar time, especially when it comes to these new businesses, these new endeavors.
It's like, oh, financial services, we can crack that. And then the realities hit home and they're like,
Because Apple Pay later didn't really provide a benefit to Apple other than just being a feature. Apple Card provides a lot of benefit to Apple. Whether any future financial services that Apple was working on provide a benefit and whether those have been scrapped, who knows? But it's clear some rethinking is going on. Speaking of rethinking and changes to plans, and the information says that Apple has paused its work on Apple Vision Pro 2 and is instead making a cheaper version of an Apple Vision headset the priority. The information says it's possible Apple could resume work on a high-end second-gen Vision Pro at some point, but for right now, they've shifted the focus to something cheaper. The information speculates or suggests that Apple is aiming for a price of around $1,500, which is similar to the cost of like an iPhone 15 Pro Max. The one thing, the big detail, the big key that the information doesn't have any details on is how are they going to lower the price? How are they going to get from $3,500 to $1,500? The speculation has always been, A, they can remove the EyeSight screen on the outside. B, they can use cheaper materials. And C, the economies of scale, basically.
That's not going to get you half the price.
I don't think so. The difference between $1,500 and $3,500, I don't think will sell enough Apple Visions to help get that production cost and that supply cost down. And
I mean, from all intents and purposes, the micro OLED displays are still really hard to produce and the yields are really low. So like the price of those screens are not going to go down sharply. It's not even like a demand issue. Like if Apple was selling Vision Pros like hotcakes, they'd run out. You know, the capacity to build those screens is not there yet, which is part of the reason why I think it's $3,500, because they know that they couldn't have it cheaper because they wouldn't be able to sell them. But so I think the biggest way that they could knock the price down is if they use lower quality screens, but that's then sacrificing a big tenet of the appeal of the product.
And especially if you make that sacrifice and you significantly reduce the quality of the screens, I think people are going to want a lower price than even $1,500. Because then you're looking at the comparisons between something like the Quest and Vision Pro, and that's 500. The Quest versus Apple Vision, and that's 500 mm-hmm. versus 1500. That's still a lot of money.
Yeah, there is a question about, like, 3500 is too much, right? Mm-hmm. Is 1500, 600 cheap enough, or is that still not enough to move the needle? Like,
yeah,
the Vision situation is still so premature and so early that you almost just, like, when people say, what does it need to, like, pop off? It's like, well, it just needs everything. Like, you know, it needs cheaper, better ergonomics, better fit, lighter, you know, faster, better graphics, like, better software. You know, everything about it can just get better and better over time. And then eventually those elements will come together to a product with, you know, much more mass appeal. I don't think it's like, well, if the Vision Pro was half the price, it would then be really popular. It's like, it'd be more popular, but I don't think it'd be, like, super popular. I think the Quest would still dominate by a country mile. And so I'm not sure there's anything they could do in a 1 year, 2 year time frame that makes the product a breakout success, right? It's a long-term vision.
Long-term vision.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the idea of Apple having to stop or pause work on Vision Pro 2 in order to focus on this lower cost Vision headset? To me,
yeah, that's the stupidest thing ever.
It suggests that the team working on Vision Pro is perhaps even smaller than we thought. It gives me bad vibes about the resources being dedicated to Vision Pro internally.
Yeah, I mean, look at the iPhone. They're developing, what, 3-4 generations of iPhone years at the and there's multiple models per year at the same time. Like, there's so much concurrent work going on. You know, the iPad, when they work on the M4 iPad Pro, they're also working on the M5 iPad Pro at the same time. Like, you know, there's a development pipeline. It's so weird that, like, engineering has been, like, pulled off the high-end headset just to go and work on the cheap version. Like, they don't have the bandwidth to move both projects forward. That is weird. The only question here is, did the information get the story right? Because in fairness, Mark at Bloomberg did previously say that a Vision Pro second gen wasn't due until late 2026 at the earliest, and they were working on the cheaper version to get out the door first. So maybe this is kind of like a regurgitation of what was always planned, and, like, the Vision Pro 2 was never coming sooner, and so always the plan was to get the cheaper one out as the next priority, and then they'd move on to the Vision Pro 2 afterwards. But either way, it still sounds weird.
It's added confirmation that that's what's happening.
Yeah, the information report kind of spells out that the original plan, which has been corroborated many times, was that the next generation would have a cheaper option and the high-end second-gen option come out about the same time. So you'd have, like, two models the next time around. And now what's happening is it's going to be the one model, i.e. the cheaper model. And who knows what the future of the higher expensive model is.
Would 1500 get you to pull the trigger on something?
Yeah, I think so.
You think, like, so?
That's more amenable to me. I mean, yeah. I don't think it makes much difference to the average person. But for me, that's enough to, like, not buy it on a lark, but you know what I mean? Like, there's more... It's a cool thing. And if you're just going to watch the movies on it, do a little bit of stuff here and there, that's enough to get in the door, right? And, like, enjoy it without feeling like I've just wasted a load of money. Like, on that metric, there's a big difference between 1500 and 3500. However, it depends, like, what they take out of it, to be honest. Like, if I see the Vision Pro hardware right now as, like, almost a baseline of quality, and if they take out a lot to get down that price, I probably wouldn't get it. It wouldn't have the same appeal. If it was the same product, or at least, like, the same quality screens, the same performance, then maybe. But you got to remember, at the moment, the Apple Vision Pro is already kind of behind on silicon because it's the M2, and we're already on, like, M4. If this cheaper one comes out end of 2025 and it's still M2, that'll feel bad as well, you know? Like,
yeah.
So there's some question marks. Let me put it a different way. If the Apple Vision Pro had come out at $1,600, I'd have bought one.
Yeah, it sounds like what you want is just a price cut for the Vision Pro.
But you, which I'm not saying it's practical or feasible. But yeah, that's what I feel like. What's kind of what people want? Like the Vision Pro is you. I mean, I still haven't used one, but you can tell, right? You use it and it's impressive, and that goes. You know, that gets you for the enthusiast. That gets you to a grand, and then it's like, well, it's a bit more, and you'll get one. Like 3,500 is a bit of a leap too far.
All right, I think that does it for this week. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a rating and a review. You can find an ad-free version of the show at 9to5mac.com/join with bonus content every week. Send us feedback, happyhour@9to5mac.com. I am on Threads, Twitter, Mastodon, @ChanceHMiller. And Mayo, what about you?
@BZAMayo.
All right, thanks, Mayo.
Bye-bye.